You've asked a question about how do we practice when things are really difficult. In the last 2 years, there have been a lot of questions about that, a lot of questions about how to practice in challenging times, and I've thought about that quite a bit. Part of what prompted that, of course, was that we had a pandemic, and part of it was politics, and more recently, it's been one or the other of the many, many tragic acts of violence in a few of the places in the world. When someone comes in for the kind of meeting that we call an interview in our community, not like a job interview, but like your view meets my view, interweaving our views together as one exploration, I sometimes ask, you know, can you summarize what you're bringing? And it's often something along the lines of times are challenging and I feel despair. And that covers a lot of ground, of course, but the general texture at least is clear. And there's no telling what I'll say when you say that, because it has to do with what my heart is saying in that moment. But what I'm thinking on the inside much of the time is good. Good. You have connected in an honest way with the first noble truth. Truth of suffering. There's no avoiding it. Suffering will be a fact of your life if you're a human being. And I always hope that maybe you'll find some encouragement to know that this is where the Buddha started also. And most students will ask a question, something along the lines of, well, what should I do? And the answer, and I always think this to myself before I give an answer, but the actual answer is, I don't know. I don't know what you should do. But what I do know is that it might be helpful to run a handful of experiments, and then you will know, you will learn what you should do. When you find yourself in a difficult situation and you want to show up for that, and when you want to take action, so maybe you see two people talking to each other and one of them is saying things that are just really not tenable, really not appropriate. What do you do? Many people have that question in an interview lately, and I say, really, they do the only thing you can do, which is you check your motivation. Why are you doing this? This is a one-second check-in. You don't need to think about this. It's not that kind of a conceptual discernment. You check in with your heart. Are you triggered? Is this a pattern? Or are you showing up for more enlightened reasons? That is, are you showing up for reasons of kindness and generosity and compassion? So once you've done that check-in, then you should stay focused on two things. One is, don't give up. Don't give up on suffering beings. And benefit everybody equally. Don't give up on suffering beings and benefit everybody equally. That's the kind of willingness to practice in the face of your fear and your doubt and the challenges. And I think that's actually exactly what it takes to practice in times like that. Another thing that's helpful is to believe that you can do this, to have some faith or confidence. And how will you have that? How will you know? Well, you do it. That's the only way you can know. That's where faith and confidence come from. You do it and you do your best and you do it with appropriate motivation to benefit beings. You do it with a sense of equality. All these beings in this equation are precious, whether I personally agree with them or not, whether I personally relate to them or not, no matter how different they are from me. So you show up in that way, and then you come to a moment of awareness. I usually drop my awareness to my feet or in my belly. so that I know that I'm not about to act on a pattern, and then I do whatever seems like it needs to be done. And all of that, every bit of that that I just said, is a few seconds. It has to come from a place of clear seeing and wisdom. Otherwise, the best thing you can do is refrain. Why? Because you would be acting from your confusion. You would be spreading your confusion. You would be starting another war. So what else is helpful when you're practicing with difficult things? I think in a way you have to relinquish this kind of long-term hope for a better world. I know that's a little bit harsh, but what I mean is decide that you don't want to wait for that to do something about it. Decide that you are willing to show up for the world exactly as it is. And I mean the world without any exception. And so you do show up in that way, and you do show up with that urgency, and you do show up as a matter of this moment. This is what life is asking me to do. And you do it without giving up, and you do it to benefit every single person in the equation, like I said before. And this is what you don't do when things are difficult. I think there's a natural response to think, I'll take care of me, and when I'm able, when I'm better, when I feel better, when I'm more stable, whatever, I'll take care of that, and then when I'm able, I'll go into the darkness of the times. Now, there's a little bit of a wisdom process here, right? Because if you are completely disabled, that's exactly what you should do. But if you're just waiting for the magical day to appear when you are totally balanced, totally at ease, totally nourished, totally refreshed, you will never take action. You will never take action. So you have to start from a place of more generosity than that. That kind of self-focus is not self-care. That is self-harm. And I say this understanding that there are times for all of us and there are people for whom that is an appropriate approach. We have to bring some sense to this, common sense, and also some wisdom. But if you're not careful, if it's always about you not doing something because you're not feeling strong enough or robust enough, it might be a mistake. That might just intensify your suffering. That might be what's driving you to come to this interview and ask the question. That might actually be the enemy. What else do you have to do when it's difficult? You have to cultivate the intention and the willingness to go into the difficulty wholeheartedly. You have to not separate yourself from the experience. You have to not separate yourself from the people. None of them. You are those people. You are both sides. There is no room for blame. So how do you work with an enemy, a real enemy? When you are not in a moment of conflict, all the time, you should be contemplating this question. What's the enemy? By enemy, I mean, what's the source of suffering? What's the mechanism of suffering? Where does it come from? Because that's the enemy. That's the enemy for you, for me, for everybody that was ever born in a human body. Because if you classify somebody else as the enemy for another reason, you probably have just started another war, and that war is your fault. You got to own that. If they have a difference of opinion from you or a different culture or a different ideology and you call those people the enemy, you've started another battle. So how do you relate to the enemy? You have to find your common identity with them, your commonality. What might that be? Well, one thing, for example, could be that those enemies, all of them, they have their own story for fighting. They have their own reasons, just like you, just like me. If you go back far enough in time, if you were to go up from the earth 10,000 feet and look down, you would see, I believe, and you would understand what their reasons are. And what we're seeing when we see a battle or a conflict is kind of a time frame which freezes the right and wrong side of an issue. It freezes it in a moment in time. And so it can look like, oh yeah, really clear, here's the enemy and here's the victim. But if you took a longer time frame and you looked at that same dynamic, those same people, the perpetrator and the victim might be turned around. So we have to have something more equanimous than taking sides. You could also go to a tendency, a conflict tendency, for example, that we all share. So for example, it's a pretty much universal human tendency to grasp onto territory and then to enlarge it and protect it. In some ways, as human beings, we spend most of our life energy doing that, whether the territory is a feeling or an experience, or a piece of land, our body, our ideology. I heard something on the radio today. A woman told her child he was being, this is a black mother talking to her son, you are being a right supremacist. R-I-G-H-T, a right supremacist. Because he was being so fixed in his opinions. That's an example of personal territory. That's what we do. So when you feel like these people are fighting for their territory, can you relax your mind to have a big enough view to see? That's what we do. That's what we do. And can you work to end that war, not to exacerbate it or continue it? At the very least, could you stand there witnessing that universal tendency playing out and cut through the false belief that you are somehow not like that? That would be a step towards ending a war. So people ask, you know, it's the most common follow-on question. Well, should we not take action? Please stop asking that question. I mean, I'm kind of kidding. You can ask it all you want. But of course we should take action. We're always called to do that. Our life is about action. As long as you remember that sometimes the right action is actually to refrain, to do nothing, or to pause, or to pause until you're clear, in which case you can't do anything because you can't get clear. Why would we do that? Because if you don't, you just spread your confusion. Confusion, territoriality, fixed opinion, these are human diseases. So in that moment, if you're experiencing it, you should not be taking a side. If you are going to take action, how do you know what to do? Well, one thing is you should check in and see, am I acting out a habitual pattern to be angry, to be dominant, those kinds of things? Or am I acting out a clear-minded action which is unconditioned, which is coming free from my heart mind, which is awake in this moment, which is more free from confusion rather than mired in confusion? You know, and then you do what you do, like I said before, and you stay present for the result and you learn. And next time you will do possibly a little bit better. So if we talk about how do we gain the ability or nurture the ability or tune the ability to do this work, I think the answer is, if you want to stop war, you want to stop violence, you have to stop it in yourself. You have to create peace. And really, the only way I know to create peace is to actually practice. And what I do not mean by that, specifically do not mean, is you are not building a hut of peace for yourself. That's what the people who are fighting are doing. They're trying to build a little hut of peace for themselves. I don't blame them. I want one too. But you said it yourself when you came and asked me this question. You said, it doesn't work. You're right. In fact, it's fishy. You know, if you're doing your meditation practice, you're doing your Tonglen, you're doing your 7 points of mind training, and it feels like you are strengthening this little hut, this little cocoon around you. It's very peaceful. It's very pleasant. It's very smooth and even. It has no cracks. It has no leaky roof. Really, you are not practicing. Something is fishy about that. And if you think that one action, one thought, one word is going to solve much, you're wrong. This has to be continuous. This is a life work, many lives' works. And so I want to say one more thing about this. I think to do all of this, it's helpful to have a teacher. Helpful to have a teacher, a guide. But I want to say something about teachers. In order to have a teacher, in order for you to have a teacher, that teacher must have a student. And if you want that person to be a teacher, you have to show up as the student. Because no matter who's in the room, Buddha could be in the room. If there is no student, there is no teacher. They co-arise. They arise together. What else about having a teacher? Well, if you want to work with a teacher, you have to go where they are. You have to meet them. And I'm not really talking about a place, but let's talk about it kind of metaphorically. How do you know if you found a teacher, the teacher? How do you know if you found their house, their hut of no peace? How do you know if you found it? So you go in, and the first thing you notice is that there was a front door, but there's no exit. That's one of the ways you know you're in the right place. By that, I mean that sometimes the teacher will put you on the spot and you will not feel comfortable. You'll feel challenged. And the teacher's presence and your presence will hold you in that moment of feeling you are in a spotlight of some kind. But if it's a real teacher, they are holding you with only one thing in mind, and that is your awakening. So how else do you know you actually got to the teacher's hut, the teacher's house? Well, if this is a genuine teacher, there's always somebody practicing in there. Always. Nothing else happens in the teacher's house. So whatever they're doing, you have to ask, what is this practice? What does this have to do with my awakening? One of the ways that I know when I'm in my teacher's hut is that it's very, very small. It's very small. It feels so intimate. It feels so like no room to wiggle. And somehow, because of the teacher, it's also very spacious. So there's room to do that intimate work in this big, giant, vast container of no judgment and all the space I need. In the real teacher's house, there is always room for you, always room for you. In fact, if it's a real teacher, there's always room for all beings, every single one. There are no enemies in the house of the teacher. That's how you know you've arrived there. And when you get there, you must practice. The teacher lives for your awakening. If they have any other agenda, something's wrong. And so when you come, you must come for your awakening. And your awakening is about practice. So no matter whatever you're doing there, an interview or housework or gardening or cooking or talking or reading a book or whatever, it's all practice. So you want to make peace, you want to stop the war, you do it right there. You do it right there. If you discover inside that small, big room of the teacher that the war is actually your war with yourself or your war with your parents who died a long time ago, stop the war. Stop the war. Or maybe you have a war in the moment with practice itself. Or maybe you feel at war with the teacher. Stop the war. You came to make peace. Make peace. Stop. Look. Because that person sitting across from you, that's not your teacher. You come to see me. I'm not your teacher. That awareness you use to see, that awareness you use to feel the answer, to feel what to do, to guide you in stopping the war in that moment and every moment that came before and after, that's your teacher. That's my teacher too. So those are my thoughts about how to practice when things are difficult.